So,
hello, I'm Simon Mercier. Welcome to Crave, the podcast dedicated to music, movies, television, theatre, in fact, anything that's been entertaining me and Steve McCabe lately.
And this week we have plenty of live music to chew over, from the Auckland City Limits Festival, where acts as diverse as Grace Jones, Beck, and Aussie busking sensation Tash Sultana entertained the crowd.
They did, and they were joined by plenty of good local talent too. We'll also chat about Bruno Mars' shows this last week in Auckland.
And we have a spy movie with a very, very hard edge. Possibly too hard for some people. We'll discuss the new Jennifer Lawrence film, Red Sparrow.
We shall. We'll also talk about, I'll talk about a film. Well, it's not a film yet. It's a music album at the moment. It's a new album from the New Zealand singer-songwriter Marlon Williams, which we previewed actually a few months ago. The full album is out now. It's called Make Way for Love.
Now, a few weeks ago, I reported from Auckland's Laneway Festival. And this week, Simon, you spent the day at Western Springs for what's been described as the biggest music event of the year, even bigger than Laneway. This will be the Auckland City Limits Festival. So, what do we think?
What we think is generally pretty good. I hadn't been to this before. This is the second time it's come to Auckland. This is it's a franchise festival, isn't it, Steve? Like the Laneway one you went to. So, it's worth spending a minute just describing how it all works. If you're familiar with Western Springs Stadium, you've got the actual stadium proper where the amphitheater and the old speedway track's there. So you've got two stages in that part of Western Springs, and then two other stages over the hill where all the sports fields are near the road, the main road. So what they do is they have one band playing in each location, and while that band's playing, they're setting up on the stage right next to it.
Oh, wow.
So effectively, you go through the whole day and you will almost always have live music playing all the time. I thought that worked pretty well. You've got a choice, you know, in front of you, a choice to be made for all the hours that you're there. And in between the two areas where they play the music, you've got all the food and the other facilities. So I thought the actual layout and the organization was pretty good. I spent most of the day there, Steve, and suffered from exhaustion by the end of it.
It's a long day, isn't it?
It's a long day. So I've got a lot to say about it on our website, cravepodcast.com. So do head over there and have a read through. I'll just go over some of the highlights for you now. I started with the first part of the day was, as it tends to be, local acts. Mm-hmm. Not this is what happened in Laneway, Steve, but that's what they did in the City Limits Festival.
Yeah.
The very first band I saw really made an impression on me. This a three-piece heavy metal outfit from a town called Waipu, north of Auckland.
Know it
well.
The
band's called Alien Weaponry. And that's probably a pretty good hard heavy metal name, isn't it? And these guys were playing thrash metal, going full out. They're teenagers. They're dressed in black, of course. They're letting their long hair flow and beat out the rhythm of their music, and you think, okay, this is just any old teenage heavy metal band. But no, these guys made an incredible impression because they're very political. They're only 15 and 17 years old, and they're writing, I mean, I say political, songs about Maori injustice, about New Zealand history, and they're singing in Maori.
Really?
Now, they all look very pale-skinned, but I understand they do have Maori heritage. There are two brothers and a third player. I mean, they're singing songs like about a colonial act of 1863, which that was viewed as an injustice. There was an instrumental about the ancestors of the Maori coming to New Zealand from Hawaiki, the ancestral homeland in the Pacific. And would you believe – I couldn't believe this. They had a song called Whisper.
Yeah.
Which they said, this is about the former Reserve Bank governor and former leader of the National and ACT parties, Don Brash.
Wow.
Now, how many 15 and 70-year-olds are singing songs about that?
Even Jacinda Ardern doesn't get songs written about her. No. That's not bad.
No. So, look, it's heavy metal. It's not easy listening. But I just couldn't help.
To be fair, nothing about Don Brash will ever be easy listening, will it?
No. So... they made a hell of an impact on me just because they were so into it, so committed, so political.
That's fabulous.
But, yeah, nice to see some, and you know, very New Zealand. So that was great.
Yeah.
I saw a range of other local acts. Some I'd heard about before. I mentioned one singer who I hadn't certainly heard her name, but never seen live before. Aradhna is her name, from down Wellington way.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's got Indian and Samoan heritage. Beautiful soul voice, Steve. And particularly the ballads were really, really lovely. One song she'd written herself called Brown Girl made a big impression. So I'd got my way through most of the afternoon following a bunch of New Zealand acts, enjoyed it very much. But there was one act I was really looking forward to in the early evening. Bit written about her, this busker from Melbourne called Tash Sultana.
Now, you have mentioned her to me in conversations off podcast. You were most impressed, weren't you?
I was. She's 22. She's busked for years in Melbourne. She is a multi-instrumentalist. And I think she plays music. I think, Steve, you remember you telling me about how Ed Sheeran played by playing music and recording it and then adding layer upon layer. Is that right?
He builds his loops live on stage, yes.
Right, right. So this is exactly what she does.
Oh, wow.
Superbly well. She plays guitar with a wonderful touch. She plays keyboards. She plays drums. She plays trumpet. She plays pan flute.
As you do.
And with a wonderful touch. And it's, I don't know how Sheeran presented it, but I guess to be thinking about all this music you're making and all the instruments you have to play, you have to be in the moment, surely. So you really felt like you were being drawn into this organic creation on stage.
Yeah.
Her voice is good. I hadn't really heard that much about her until recently. There was a very, very young crowd there, or I'd say from teenagers to early 20s, who just obviously knew her very well, sang along to a couple of the songs and were just in awe of her. And I have to say, I ended up being in awe of her too. Just a really mesmerizing, wonderfully entertaining show. And if she ever comes back to New Zealand, her name is Tash Sultana, and I would truly recommend her. Fantastic.
And that's then quite just an endorsement. See, yeah. Now, tell me very quickly, you mentioned Ed Sheeran, and I noticed that his support act for his forthcoming shows in Auckland, the Drax Project.
Oh, okay. Yes. So I will mention them, Drax Project. Four-piece band. I think they're out of Wellington way, I believe.
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, young guys. Also quite, as many bands seem to be, that they all play different instruments. Either they play pop, catchy pop with a bit of reggae, hip-hop influence. Very popular with the young audience watching them. Their frontman, Shan Singh, was an interesting frontman because he was singing but also playing saxophone.
Saxophone?
Yes.
That's rock and roll, isn't it?
Yeah. I enjoyed them. Yeah, good catchy pop. I think that's the best way to describe it. And they certainly, the young ones who were there really enjoyed them.
Did you just say the young ones?
I did, and that's what I was going to ask you about that, because when you go to something like this, they've obviously had to, the organisers have to come up with a mix of acts to appeal to a range of people, huh? And I don't know what it was like.
How were you finding a range of people here? We're talking about
ages and tastes.
Okay.
So there were some bands where you looked like there were teenagers and maybe, teenagers watching. Other bands, well, I'll get to Grace Jones.
Yeah.
30, 40, 50-year-olds were the main audience members. Is that how it was at Laneway? The kind of a mixture of that along those lines?
Yeah, pretty much. And as the day went by and you started getting, the bigger acts and the longer established acts, and obviously they tended to have the longer tail behind them in terms of age.
Yeah. So that's how it went. And I just finished with the evening. I concentrated on Grace Jones. I'm a bit older than you, so maybe she was a bit more present in my earlier years than she was for you. But I just before she went on stage, I caught up with another music journalist who told me he'd seen a documentary, a very recent documentary, in which she performed mostly sitting down.
I heard about this, yes.
Yeah, and he wondered whether she wasn't, how well she was. She was 69, 70, and so I was not sure what to expect. And in fact, I think the audience wasn't sure too. It took a few songs to get into it, but she was full on, the costumes, the makeup. She moved well on these ridiculously high heels, dancing, kicking, strutting, gyrating. Her voice was really strong. She played the big hits you'd expect. As well as a little unaccompanied version of Amazing Grace, which went down rather nicely.
Unexpected.
And the last song, of course, had to be Pull Up to the Bumper.
Well, obviously.
it was fantastic. It was just fantastic. And what added to the occasion was, I mean, she had a great band. What added to the occasion, there was a pole on stage.
Yeah.
And a young, near naked young man, his skin adorned with Maori type motifs, came up and sort of gyrated and swung around the pole like a sort of combination of a gymnast and a pole dancer, to the song, with her grace engaging from time to time. It was kind of a interesting way of presenting the song, but added to the occasion. Everyone just loved it. Not a long set. Most of these sets tend to be 45 to 50 minutes.
Yeah.
For me, it was a great highlight, and it was a fantastic song to finish. I guess she sung Put Up to the Bumper, I don't know, a million times, but it was really, really good. And I'll just finish with a guy who I think you know much more about than I do. That's Beck.
Yes.
You quite like Beck, don't you?
He has his moments. I mean, I have fond memories from back in my 90s days.
Okay.
Of him doing complex, multi-layered instrumental stuff, which I can't imagine would translate onto stage very well.
Well, I'll be honest with you. It was the last act I saw. I was fatigued by the stage.
Well, you would be. It's a long day, isn't it?
So I probably didn't quite devote the energy I should have. Look, I think he played with a full band. The band was good. He started off with some fairly upbeat numbers. Kind of the first couple of songs were quite rocky, and then he moved into something which is a bit more hip-hoppy or rappy, I guess. And I started to lose a bit of interest at that point, just quietly. And I thought his voice was okay, but nothing to write home about.
He can be a bit whiny, can't he?
I hope I'm not committing sacrilege in saying that. So I did four or five songs, and I felt I had the measure of him. And I thought, yeah, good band, but I'm not.
Work here is done.
No, work is done. So felt I'd, you know, overall, a great day, a long day, a great mix of music, which I guess is what you want.
Yeah.
Head over to our website. You can read more about it. I think the only thing I'd say, Steve, if we get a chance to do it next time, we should both go.
Yes.
We can divide up the work. That would be good.
Well, there's a lot of acts. I mean, I'm looking at the lineup here. And I mean, trust me, I'm not faulting, because I know you worked hard yesterday. But I'm seeing bands like the Libertines, who would have been fun to cover.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But, you know, there's only one of you. We only got one pass. you can't be at every stage for every show. So
no, I think what you have to. What I decided to do is I made a selection.
Yeah.
And pretty much I stuck to that.
You have to, don't you?
You can't. Yeah. Although I did, on the way by chance, come across a young Norwegian pop singer called Sigrid.
You seem to have an affinity with Eastern European or Middle European types, don't you?
Yeah. Well, do you know we've got a dedicated Norwegian listener to our podcast?
Yes, I know. Yeah.
His name's Toria. He came to New Zealand.
I know.
He lives in the far north of Norway in a place called Tromsø. So, Toria, if you are listening to us today, I can recommend your countrywoman Sigrid. She put on a fantastic show, very energetic, and she was only 21, and she just. Everyone just thought she was fantastic. So there you go. You never know what you're going to find in these festivals.
That was a brave attempt at the pronunciation of the name.
Yeah, thank you.
I mean it's probably Susan. But you did well. You tried. You certainly you took a swing at it, didn't you?
I did. So look, I've had enough to say about some live music, but we've got more live music to discuss. And Steve, you've got our frequent and talented contributor Debbie with you, I think, right now.
Absolutely.
Is she not? Debbie, hi.
Hi, Simon.
Now, you have been not at a big festival, but you have caught a pretty big name in popular music. His name's Bruno Mars.
Yep.
And he was at Spark Arena this last week, huh?
Yes, he was.
Okay, what do you think of the guy?
Well, I have to warn you, I have nothing bad to say about Bruno Mars. It was all good, everything.
Well, that's okay. If that's what you honestly think, that's fantastic.
Yep.
Did you go into this being very familiar with his work?
Oh yeah, I've loved Bruno Mars since I first heard of him so long ago.
Well, I think he's in his 30s now, so he's been around for a few years, huh?
Yeah, I guess so. I'm not really sure of the dates, but yeah, he's been around for a while.
Okay, what did you like about the show, the live show?
It was at Spark Arena, which I love. It's a great venue. He had a really small stage, so the whole show had this feeling of being really personal. I'm not sure why, but it really just did. It really worked. It felt like he was there for us, for just that crowd.
Okay. And a small stage, but did he have a big band with him?
He had six guys on stage with him, so there were seven of them all together. Yeah. Let's see, there was, I'm trying to think, the guys in the back were the drummer and I think a keyboardist, if I'm not mistaken. And then there were four guys who were up sort of in a line often on stage with him, either dancing or playing various instruments, guitar, bass. I think there were some trombone stuff going on at one point. And they were all wearing sports jerseys of various sporting teams. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, there was like a little theme to it. It was really casual, really funky, really cool.
Oh, nice. And sports, like New Zealand sports teams or American? Or
American
sports. Could you tell?
They were American sport teams. There was like the Phillies. There was, oh gosh, I can't remember any of them now.
Baseball or football teams or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Lakers. Hey, so just, is he a kind of a guy who has a bit to say in between his songs? Does he talk to the crowd? Or tell me how he takes us through the show.
Oh, yeah. He really interacted with the crowd a lot. He did talk. He went to each side of the stage and had people, you know, making a lot of noise, that kind of thing. It felt really personal. Like I said, it was really interesting. I'm not sure exactly how he pulled that off, but I think the small stage was part of it. His high energy was another part of it. He really felt like he was interacting with the crowd quite a bit.
Nice. So let me get to a basic question, Debbie, and forgive me for this. Apart from something like, is it Uptown Funk?
Yeah.
That, which is, I guess, one of his big, big songs. I'm really not that familiar with his music. So for someone like me who isn't, just tell me a little bit about the sort of style of songs he's presenting.
Well, I think a lot of them are very similar to Uptown Funk. Very big, really big sound, high energy, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yep.
Which were your favorites? Did you have some highlights of the night for you?
Yeah, there was 24 Karat Magic, which he played really early on. I think it was song number two. And, of course, Uptown Funk. And I'm trying to think of some of the other names. There was Perm. There was, I think it's Chunky. There was a lot of really good songs. It was a great set list. It was amazing.
Oh, fantastic. And so he played, I think, you caught one of the early shows in the week, huh? But he played several nights.
That's true. And I wish I had tickets for every single one of them. I would have seen him four times in a row.
what an endorsement.
I know. It was so fun.
Well, that's the key thing, the fun part of it. Because I kind of, Steve and I have been talking the last few weeks when we were talking about music and movies. And there's a lot of, with all the, I don't know, the politics in the world these days, you know, often entertainment ends up having a bit of an edge to it. But was he just a fun night out?
I think he was just really a fun night out. And the whole crowd, the demographic was pretty mixed. There were, people probably in their 60s, 50s, 40s, 30s, 20s. There were some younger than 20s as well. A few little kids. I think people brought families. There were couples. It was a really good crowd. And the people had so much fun. I was down in the pit, pretty close to the stage, which I think was really good for the whole energy of the concert for me personally. But I did look around and I was watching what people were doing, you know, even way up in the stands, and people were standing, they were dancing, they were having a great time, which isn't always true for every concert. I noticed sometimes the people way at the top are kind, it's almost as if they're watching other people at a concert. But not at Bruno Mars. I think everyone was having a fantastic time, including Bruno Mars and his whole entourage there on stage.
Yeah,
everyone was having a great time.
I'm sure that's the trick to it. If the the main guy doesn't look like he's enjoying it, then we won't either.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, well that's great. Look, any other highlight I've neglected to ask you about that you'd want to raise before we wrap up our chat about Bruno?
Yeah, the other things I would say is I was kind of surprised at how small he is. He's quite short and hadn't quite really realized that. I mean, I kind of knew that, you know, from seeing music videos, but seeing him on stage was, when he first came on, I was like, wow, he's really small. But then by the end of the concert, you totally forgot about that because he's huge. So that was cool.
Maybe that's why they used a small stage.
Maybe. But it did, that small stage gave it a really personal feel. And his voice was just as good live as it was on his recorded music. That's what I thought. So,
fantastic.
Yeah, that was a really good point of the concert as well.
Good stuff. Wow, that was a great review. Thank you so much, Debbie.
Should I mention the opening act?
Go on.
Yeah, Dua Lipa. She is. She was originally a YouTube star of some sort, although her father was in a rock band, apparently. But she was great. She had an amazing voice. She had a really strong, amazing voice. She had a very small backing band. I think it was just three guys. But it was so much fun that when she left the stage, I looked down at my watch and I thought, wow, how long has that been? It had been like a good 45 minutes, I think. And it felt like it was probably about 20 minutes. I was so shocked when she left the stage. It was that good. So she was really, really good as well.
And give us her name again.
Dua Lipa. Yeah, she's English. I don't know too much about her, and I wasn't too familiar with her. I'd heard a few of her songs, but I was quite pleased to see her. She was a great opening act.
Okay, well, look out for that name in the future, Dua Lipa.
Yep.
Thank you so much, Debbie.
Okay.
Cheers.
All right, thanks, Simon. Bye.
Bye.
Right, let's turn our attention to the screen now, shall we, Simon?
Let's do that.
I think the big thing we have to look at this week is very definitely the new release from Jennifer Lawrence, which looks from the trailers like a sort of a classy spy thriller, a classic spy thriller. Mm. Red Sparrow, what do we make of it?
Yeah. Well, as you say, Jennifer Lawrence, she plays this Red Sparrow, basically a woman who trains to be a seductress for the Russian Secret Service.
Yes.
Interesting premise. I think I'll let you kick this one off, Steve. I've been gabbling on about music for a bit. What did you make of it?
Well, it's a very troubling film. And I saw it yesterday.
Yep.
I've had 24 hours and I'm still trying to figure out what I even make of it. So as you say, the basic premise is we got Jennifer Lawrence in a well dodgy Russian accent playing a ballerina for the Bolshoi Ballet, mm-hmm. who comes a cropper quite badly on stage. And we're treated to a very graphic scene of a leg bent sideways.
Yes.
After she injures herself. And it turns out that because she's no longer dancing, she no longer gets the grace and favour flat that she had, thanks to the ballet.
Yes.
And her mother, who suffers from a non-specific but hospice-worthy illness, is now likely to find herself pitched out of said flat.
Yes.
And so her profoundly creepy Uncle Vanya,
yes,
who it turns out is working for, or is quite high up in, director possibly. It's kind of hinted at that he's a director. Is it the SVR, is it called? The Russian Secret Service?
Yeah, he's Russian. I think he's a deputy director. He's high up, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
And he is lizardly beyond belief.
Yeah.
Hints that unless she plays ball with him, then said mother will find herself in a state-run hospice.
Yeah.
And so Dominika Egorova is her name, will have to agree to doing a particularly nasty assignment, seducing
a CIA agent. Yeah.
Well, no, before that, if you remember, there's going to be one particularly important scene where she is told that she will have, all she has to do is take one guy back to a hotel room, she'll be protected, everything goes to plan. She will switch phones and life is good.
Yes.
And then that's it. She's going to be taken care of by the SVR. It goes horribly, gruesomely, viciously and nastily wrong.
Mm.
But now she is in the pocket of Uncle Vanya.
Yeah.
Played with delightful villainousness and a striking similarity to Vladimir Putin by Matthias Schoenaerts.
Yes.
Oh, he's foul. He's really pleasingly foul in this.
Yeah, he does a good job in the role. I agree.
Yeah.
Yep.
So then she shunted off to this non-specific academy where she's going to be trained up to be a sparrow.
Mm.
And the academy is led by Matron.
Yes.
Played by Charlotte Rampling, who is seriously channeling Theresa May.
Is that what it is?
That's all I could see. She's Theresa Matron. She really is. It was disturbing. That's all I could see every time she was on screen.
That's interesting.
She was Theresa May. But anyway, what we're told is that the sparrows are selected for their beauty. And so they will be trained to seduce their marks, supply them with what is perceived as their needs, and then manipulate them into giving what we want from them.
Yes. And there's a key part, isn't there, Steve, where the uncle, I think it is, says to her, what you need to do and what you're good at, niece,
is looking at someone and figuring out what their weakness is.
Exactly.
And that becomes a very important theme of the whole story and as we go through.
Oh, very much so, yeah. Because the thing that they're meant to look for is a sexual thing.
Yes.
And that's really significant in this. So we're treated for the first hour of the film to insights into the sparrow's training. And yeah. It is...
confronting?
That'll do nicely. It is voyeuristically, aggressively, unpleasantly sexual. Mm. We are shown trainee sparrows being exhorted to administer oral sex on demand and then breaking down in tears when they refuse. We see Jennifer Lawrence's sparrow in particular being brutally near raped in a shower and then being told in front of an entire class to give her would-be rapist what he wants, and oh doesn't she just in a particularly ugly scene in which Lawrence is completely naked in very, very many ways. It's ugly, it's nasty, it's not in any way titillating nudity or erotic nudity. It is vicious and nasty nudity.
I think there's a line there where the matron, Rampling Steve, tries to say to these young charges, look, don't get all caught up in this, you know, embarrassment about sex. It's just bodies. It's just flesh. This is just the tools of your trade. Excuse the pun.
Decadent Western imperialist model of flesh. Your body belongs to Russian state now. Exactly. You will use your body for Russian state. Yeah. And there are lots of really bad cod Russian accents in this.
Yeah. So I mean, you can say that, but the degree to which they then show it. I think becomes a disturbing, I agree with you, becomes disturbing, and it carries on through the film. And I guess we shouldn't give away too much more of the plot, Steve, but other than to say perhaps that there's another major mission that our Red Sparrow has to embark on, which is to get close to a CIA agent.
Yes, this is Nate Nash, played by Joel Edgerton.
Played by Joel Edgerton, and then we kind of, we get into that whole sort of shtick of these sort of spy movies of you know, someone's double crossing who and how many times are they being double crossed, is it triple, quadruple crossed, and you're left guessing as you would expect to be.
You learn to explore powers of two, don't you, because you leave double and quadruple way behind.
I think it's hard. I'm actually, it's funny, I was like that too. I walked out of it and I had some thoughts, and then I had some other thoughts, and I kind of percolated away for a while, and in the end, I felt pretty unsettled, and I thought, okay, you're trying to say maybe there's maybe in this film they're trying to say, whoops, I've just dropped my camera. How unfortunate. Let me just reestablish.
That's the effect this film has on one.
Yes. I hope you can see me again. Can you?
You can. Perfect.
Lovely. There's something that gnawed away at me about this, Steve, about the way in which particularly Jennifer Lawrence's character is portrayed. I mean, she's not the only one to whom violence is meted out. But
no.
I mean, she's, as you said, she's raped. She has to get naked. There's sort of a whole range of psychological and emotional exploitation. And because she's not meant to give much away, she's kind of there on screen a lot, looking rather impassive. And I ended up thinking it's not just that the character who's being exploited. I almost felt like Jennifer Lawrence, the actress herself, was being exploited by this film being made into some sort of vehicle for her, so that the audience sits there and watches nasty things being done to Jennifer Lawrence. I mean,
I know what you mean, because there's moments when it gets extraordinarily unpleasant.
Well, yeah. And then really unpleasant.
I mean, about an hour, 45 minutes from the end, it shifts gears.
Yeah.
And it goes from being, it wants to be a psychological thriller. And it becomes a profoundly gruesome and nasty piece of violence.
And
if it was pornographic in a sexual way to begin with, and if it was pornographic, it was rapily and voyeuristically pornographic, it suddenly becomes violently pornographic. It becomes torture porn.
I can tell you that there are a couple of scenes near the end where I literally put my hand up over my face and turned to one side because I just thought, wow. And I could hear people behind me just moving in their seats and sort of going, oh, you know.
Now, you and I weren't in the same screening as this.
No.
But speaking in code here, were these scenes that possibly involved a pillow and a cushion?
That and then the that, yes.
Yeah,
and
so
then
we're
the
on the same.
Scene,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes, and then later scene involving skin.
Oh, yes. Yes, they were profoundly disturbing. And
they were.
And my thought was that there are films where you can get away with that because they've led up to this. I felt that this film shifted gears so abruptly that it hadn't earned the right to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd agree with that. And the other thing, Steve, was I guess I think Jennifer Lawrence has had a bit to say about this film in interviews, and I think she's expecting some backlash. And she said, oh, don't
well,
get
good.
Caught up in – which, yeah. And she's tried to say, you know, when the treatment of women is so much – the focus of attention at the moment, she's saying, oh, just look, this is a piece of entertainment. It's not meant to be some sort of political or social commentary. But it's hard not to react
Except
to seeing
it's
a woman
not,
treated that, that
it's
way
It's
not
on simply screen. Entertaining, is it?
No, well, it's not.
No, it's a tough watch.
It is a tough watch,
And there's... So let's look at it as a piece of entertainment. So we've got these dodgy Russian accents, because they're all Russian characters. Mm. And so they all speak English in Russian accents. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen a TV show called Jane the Virgin.
No, I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it.
No, but if anyone who's listening to this has seen that, just imagine Aneska saying beautiful sister, that you'll know what I'm talking about.
Oh, okay.
But there's these fake Russian accents. But then she goes to Budapest. And there's no reason to assume whatsoever that a ballet dancer in the Bolshoi would speak Hungarian. Mm. Except she shows up there and she speaks in the Russian accent, and obviously suddenly everyone understands her. Mm. And then Joel Edgerton's character Nate Nash meets her outside a swimming baths, where she wears the most preposterous swimsuit you've ever seen.
Yeah.
And if it's intended to seduce him, then obviously, you know, fair enough. But it's not meant for swimming in.
Right.
And he addresses her with a couple of Russian words. In Russian.
Yeah.
So they speak English, but then they go back to he speaks English with an American accent, she speaks English with the same Russian accent that she's been speaking Hungarian to the pool guards. So the way the language is handled is really, really... I mean, you must remember Allo Allo.
Yes.
It's basically accents depicting language on that level. It fails on that level. You've got Kieran Hines as Zakharov, the head of something. Somewhat non-specific job descriptions. Kieran Hines as Zakharov, who is so high up in whatever job he does, he wears a suit. And then Jeremy Irons as Korchnoi, who is clearly not quite as high because he wears a uniform. but scenery gets chewed like scenery has never been chewed
two. Yeah, I think I found some positives in it, and I think that there is a mystery going on here. You know, you're trying to find out who's... And so there is a reasonable twist at the end, I suppose.
There is, yes.
And I, just in terms of some of the actors, I did, like you, I thought Matthias Schoenaerts played the uncle very well.
Oh, yeah, he was
and
horrible.
And I quite enjoyed the work. It wasn't a big role, but there was an actress called Thekla Reuten.
Oh, yes,
who played Marta.
Yeah.
And I thought Marta was, that was a nice role. And the Mary Louise Parker plays an American bureaucrat caught up in it, and she did quite a nice job
too. I have heard it said that a lot of people see her character as almost being bolted on from a different film. It's like Parker thinks she's in a comedy,
right? Well,
and
actually,
she kind of and she's the only thing in the entire film that has any levity, any lightness to it. Everything else is relentlessly bleak.
Yeah. So my final thought was that there may have been an aim in this film to tell a story about a woman who's subjected to terrible things and rises above it.
Yeah.
I guess you could argue that's what's trying to be the tale that's trying to be told. But along the way, my gosh, I just felt tainted almost. You know, like, oh, this is just, ooh. And it didn't get there in the end for me. I felt unsettled. I can't recommend it. I can't. I just think it didn't get it right.
No, I'd like to be able to recommend it. I really, really would. But I found it very unsettling. I found it, hard to get on board with. I really, really did. It's difficult.
It is. Anyway, look, Steve, just while we're talking about movies, we should, and that's obviously neither of us are going to recommend that in any glowing terms, but there are a lot of other movies which are many people like, which we're recording this podcast on a Sunday here in New Zealand. And
is there going to be any kind of like appraisal of films coming up very shortly, any internationally acclaimed appraisal?
I think in about 24 hours' time or maybe less, the Oscars will be handed out.
Oh, that's right. I knew there was something coming up. Yes, yes.
Yes, yes. Right. Now, we've talked about some of the films in the running, and I think you've seen more of them than I have. And there's a few that I've missed out on, which possibly restricts my ability to pass a fair comment. But look, in terms of Best Picture, and these days there's a lot of movies up for Best Picture. Darkest Hour, you and I have both seen. Dunkirk, yep. We've both seen. Get Out, we've both seen. Did you see The Post? I can't remember. I did.
We talked about it together, yeah.
And The Shape of Water, I've seen.
Yes.
Three Billboards Out, Ebbing, Missouri, we've both seen.
Everybody should see it.
Yeah, I haven't seen Lady Bird, but you have. So that's the only one I haven't seen is Phantom Thread, the last film of Daniel Day-Lewis, which apparently he does it. So anyway, of the ones that you've seen, which strikes you as being the best film?
Well, I mean, as we actually come to go through the list, I realise I've been very, very remiss, and I think I've possibly seen fewer than you have. I've not seen Call Me By Your Name.
Well, I haven't seen that either. I wanted to, but I just haven't. Yeah. Apparently it's very good.
I've not seen Phantom Thread or The Shape of Water.
Okay.
However, okay. I have seen Darkest Hour, Dunkirk, Get Out, Lady Bird, The Post, and the winner, the obvious winner, which with three billboards out, you know, the clumsiest name of any film this year, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Yeah.
And let's face it, what's going to win?
Oh, I think that will win. Just very quickly, look, hey, I was, you may recall when we chatted about it, I do recall mentioning I had a slight little issue with the character arc of the young police.
The one deputy, yes.
Deputy Sam, I've got his name.
Yeah, I know who you mean, yeah. This is Sam Rockwell's character,
Sam Rockwell's character, because going from sort of this racist, violent guy to something quite different by the end. And there's been actually quite a bit written about that, I've noticed, since then. And he's apparently come out and even expressed a degree of disquiet about who his character was. I don't think that really will affect the decision, but it just goes to show, even in a fantastic movie, there's always room for debate about how certain characters are pitched and whether you believe the arc that you're invited to follow, all that sort of thing. But I think it probably will win. I think, and I think you're probably going to tell me, are you not, then, that Ms. McDormand is a shoo-in for Best Actress, are you?
I would imagine she's probably clearing out space on her mantelpiece as we speak, and I wouldn't blame her, because she is all but flawless in this film.
Yeah, she's very, very good.
Yeah, I don't see anything else winning Best Picture, seriously. Three Billboards really was that good. I mean, I came out of Dunkirk thinking, okay, I've just seen the Best Picture Oscar winner, and I'm now quite happy to accept that I was wrong.
Okay. Well, I mean, that was a very... visually a really striking film still.
Yes, it was. Well, Hans Zimmer will win for Best Score.
Okay, yeah.
Now, lead actor, who are we reckoning? We've got Timothée Chalamet for Call Me By Your Name. We've got Daniel Day-Lewis for Phantom Thread. Daniel Kaluuya for Get Out. Gary Oldman for Darkest Hour. And Denzel Washington for Roman J. Israel Esquire, which hasn't even opened here yet, I don't think.
No, I'm afraid I've only seen two of those guys of the five. So I've seen Gary Oldman and Daniel Kaluuya. So I feel rather unqualified.
But you've seen the winner, though, haven't you?
Well, I suspect I have. I mean, certainly all the talk is that this is Gary Oldman's year. He's been around for a long time, played many really good roles, and I suspect he'll get it. I mean, you think that these sort of votes are often decided by emotion and aren't they as much as anything else? And I'm sure he would be regarded as a well deserving of an Oscar by the stage of his career. So I think he'll get it.
Yeah, and it's the kind of performance that tends to attract Oscar buzz, isn't it?
It really does. Those historical characters and
And you know, there's masses of makeup involved, and he immersed himself in it. I mean, there's good performances in there, but Gary Oldman, he's going to get it. So lead actress, we've got Sally Hawkins for The Shape of Water, which you've seen and were very impressed by.
Yeah.
We've got the winner, obviously, Frances McDormand. We've got Margot Robbie in I, Tonya, Saoirse Ronan for Lady Bird, and Meryl Streep for The Post. Yeah. I mean, there's quality acting talent in there, but... Yeah.
Well, I haven't seen Saoirse Ronan. I think that Frances McDormand will get it, but you know what? Just as a sort of a outsider, I just wonder if Margot Robbie might surprise...
Well, she is brilliant.
I don't think she'll get it, but I wouldn't be, and I haven't seen Lady Bird, so I understand that Saoirse Ronan was really, really good in that. But Frances McDormand, by far the favourite.
I find myself feeling a bit bad for Ronan and Robbie because, you know, they've both turned in storming performances.
Yeah.
But let's face it, they're up against Frances McDormand in Three Billboards, and that's never going to be a fair fight.
Well, and that's, you know, that role that she plays there is a hell of a role.
Yes, a mother, it really is.
You know, a mother who's lost a child, taking up the fight as the years go by, being prepared to do things that, you know, really challenge the audience watching, and somehow keeping some sort of a, you know, chin up. I mean, there's just a lot for an actor to get into, isn't there? And, yeah. And she does pull it off very, very well.
But it's worth mentioning that, you know, you're talking about Gary Oldman and saying it's his year. Mm. And there is a degree to which you have to be seen to have paid your dues before you win an Oscar. I mean, that wasn't true for Jennifer Lawrence when she won for Winter's Bone a couple of years ago. She was very young in that. Yes. But Frances McDormand's been around forever. Margot Robbie, even though she's revealing herself to be the most astonishing actor of incredible range and depth and brilliance, she's, I mean, let's face it, she was on Neighbours last week. that is the perception. And then she was Harley Quinn the day before that. So, the perception is that she's still very new. So I don't know that it's her time yet. She is brilliant. But, you know, we have to wait for the time to come. Similar things could be said of Saoirse Ronan, to be fair.
They could.
And possibly the exact opposite could be said of Meryl Streep.
Yes. Although apparently I saw an interview where Saoirse Ronan was saying this is the third time she's been nominated for an acting Oscar.
No, but she's still
very young.
She's still a wee bairn.
A wee bairn, eh?
All right, then. She has a time. No, so, okay, support.
She's Irish, not Scottish. What am I doing? Sorry, apologies.
I teed you up for that one. I apologize. Celtic, it's all the same thing. Supporting actor, we've got Willem Dafoe in The Flora Project. We've got Woody Harrelson for Three Billboards. Richard Jenkins for The Shape of Water. Christopher Plummer for All the Moon in the World. And Sam Rockwell again for Three Billboards.
Yeah, I've not seen all of those performances. I think Sam Rockwell has already picked up some awards elsewhere. He may well get it. I actually really enjoyed Woody Harrelson's role in Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Oh, me too.
I just, it's something a little quirky about it, which I found very appealing.
I love the fact that Woody Harrelson has gone from being the bartender in Cheers to a genuinely brilliant actor, and I'd love to see him getting rewarded just for that arc.
Likewise. I agree with you. So I'd like him to win, but I don't think he probably will. And Best Supporting Actress, I haven't seen enough of them. Alison Janney was very good in I, Tonya.
Yes.
She's won some awards elsewhere. She may well... I understand Laurie Metcalf was excellent in Lady Bird as well, though, Steve.
She was very... She was a fantastic foil for Saoirse Ronan.
Yeah.
In and of herself, she was good, but the two of them together played off each other beautifully. Right. Whereas Alison Janney in I, Tonya, I mean, you've seen that one. And you know, she was... She was her own character.
Yeah, very, yeah. I mean, kind of a scene stealer, really.
Oh, yeah, and utterly terrifying with it. What a dreadful character she was.
Yeah, okay. So I think there's probably not that many surprises this year, but sometimes there are.
I think we've just spelled out exactly who is not going to win the Oscars this year.
Yeah, all right, very good. Okay, and this will be, perhaps by the time you're listening to us, the results will be just around the corner, so we can
quite
see
possibly
how well, yeah. Very good. Now, Steve, you might recall, just one last thing. Can I just quickly mention, because this is a guy we've talked about a bit earlier on previous podcasts.
Go on then, Simon, since it's you.
Yeah, thank you. This is Marlon Williams is his name. He's still a young man in his mid-ish to late 20s now. Made his name as a sort of country singer, a really, really good voice. He's not long ago released his second full album called Make Way for Love. I was lucky enough to attend a live preview of it just a few months ago, which we talked about on Crave. The full album is out now. It's, I think, really good. We're talking about, I think, some mature sort of writing. It's an album of love songs, obviously.
Yes.
Most of them, although it's bookended by two quite hopeful songs, most of it is a fairly dark exploration of the ins and outs of love gone wrong.
Right.
The production is really, really nice. I mean, honestly, he's got a heck of a voice, this guy. I think he was sang in a choir at one point in his early years, and he's got a voice which can be both mellow and deep, but also a sort of like a crooner, beautiful, ethereal, higher tone to it as well.
Yeah.
The songs are, I listened to this not long after hearing David Duchovny's attempt at lyric writing, and I thought, no, Mr. Williams, you are on the money. I would recommend it. There are a couple of standout tracks, a very, very beautifully produced ballad with his former partner, Aldous Harding, which is near the end of the album. It's a really standout track. This isn't dance music. It's not light, happy music. It's something to sort of sit down and reflect on, but just listen to his voice and what's going on. Really good. He's on a way off in Australia and Europe and the UK and North America at the moment. I think he's back here in mid-May.
Yes.
And I'll be very keen to see him if I can for a full concert. I think it'll be something to really look forward to, a standout. A talented young man, and I'm sure the best is yet to come. And he's already pretty good. Can I say?
That is a pretty full-on endorsement, really, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. I bumped into another music journalist at the festival, the City Limits Festival, and he said that album is a keeper, is the word he used. And I thought, yeah, that's a good way to describe it. It's a keeper. Anyway, Steve, we've been talking about all the music. We've just been inundating our shores. Is there much else coming up in the next week or two or three?
Well, it's worth mentioning... Marlon Williams' tour is coming up. He's going to be in Wellington at the Hunter Lounge on May the 19th.
Yeah.
He's doing the Glenroy Auditorium in Dunedin on May the 23rd. Is that right? Sorry, 22nd, I beg your pardon.
You're right.
May 23rd, he's then going up the road to Christchurch to the Foundry. And then May the 25th, he'll be up in Auckland at the Town Hall.
Yes.
So he's going to be doing the rounds.
Yes.
We've also got... there's actually not a whole lot been announced since last we spoke, to be honest.
Okay. That's all right.
I think I told you about Celine Dion adding a second date due to high demand.
Oh, yes. I was so excited I had to sit down.
I know. Contain yourself. Now, the only other interesting one... There's a band that I was not terribly familiar with, partly because they have the most clunky and awkward name.
Right.
They're called Portugal, full stop, The Man. Yes.
Uh-huh. Right.
And I'd never heard of them before until I discovered that they were playing in New Zealand and also over in the West Island as well in May. Uh-huh. And so I gave them a listen. It's really interesting, sort of multi-layered, complex art rock.
Okay.
Surprisingly good fun. And they're going to be over in Auckland on Tuesday the 8th of May at the Power Station. And I reckon that one could be worth a look.
Ah, okay, interesting. And there's obviously we're at the time of the year. There's movies being churned out left, right, and centre.
Oh dear Lord, isn't there just?
I mentioned one that I'm not. I don't think I'm going to see. But I just this trailer made me really scratch my head. They've remade that old 1970s, very violent but very influential film with Charles Bronson, which was called Death Wish.
Yes.
Which is all about a vigilante, basically. I've seen a trailer with Bruce Willis basically reinventing the role, which seems from the trailer to be the similar story, but with sort of deadpan Bruce Willis humor.
And you have to figure somebody in a movie studio somewhere sat down and said, you know what we need? We need a remake of Death
Wish.
Yeah,
and I just thought, particularly now, to make a film like that, and I don't know, and making light of it, I almost thought you could imagine the producer saying, maybe we'll wait for the gun debate to die down in the States and release it in 6 months' time. But no, they're coming out with it now. So
you don't know Americans very well, do you?
No, obviously I don't. And you know them more than I do. So I
have lived among them.
Yes. So anyway, but I don't think I'm going to rush out and see that one. But some might.
Speaking of remakes.
Yes, yes.
Am I going to see you at the preview screening of Tomb Raider?
Yes. Now,
again, who decided that needed to be remade?
Well, they chose a good actress, though.
Alicia Vikander.
Yeah, she's won some awards for her acting skills, has she not? I'm just trying to think off the top of my head, but I tell you anyway, from the trailer, and there's been a couple of trailers out for quite a while now, I think it looks quite good, actually. Just because I think she looks a cut above the sort of action hero you would expect to see, and it looks like she means business, and it's we'll see later in a week or so's time.
Well, as you say, I mean, she got the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress for Danish Girl, so clearly, you know, she knows what she's about.
Yeah.
But again, we'll find oneself wondering, what happened in the meeting when someone said, you know what we need? We need a remake of Tomb Raider. That film was so good, a whole new generation needs to enjoy it again from scratch.
Well, I'm just going to... I will add one more thought, and it's a political thought.
Go on.
And I don't know when this was... the decision to remake it was made, but, you know, there's so much in the last year being discussed about how Hollywood has let down women.
Well, that's fair.
All sorts of ways. And here's an opportunity to portray a strong woman character, smart, fast, intelligent. Just as Black Panther has received a lot of praise for its portrayal of strong women, maybe that was in the thinking. I don't know. I don't know how far back, as I say, the decision was made to make it. But I could imagine the film being quite successful because of this current debate and discussion.
Okay. I think if we're giving them the benefit of the doubt, we can go with that one. But I'd say the difference is, with Black Panther, they created something entirely new, whereas this is a retread.
Yes. It's just about the timing of the retread, isn't it? But yes, you're right.
I see the point you're making. And I'm willing to be wrong.
We'll see.
Let us judge the film on its own merits.
We shall, and we can talk about it next time. And if you have anything to add to our discussion that Steve and I have had, we're very pleased to hear from you. You can email us at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook or on Twitter at Crave Podcast.
And we're always very pleased to hear from you. There was a nice comment actually just the other day, Steve, from your a review of Queen.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that I just saw on our website, and someone else thought you were on the money and enjoyed it very, very much. So we're always pleased to hear from other people.
Absolutely,
what
shows
that you and I are talking about. Anyway, that's for now. For next time. But for now, thanks for listening. I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
That's what's been entertaining us this week.
Hasn't it just?
Right, thank you.